This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to our 13th annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson. I'm the journalism faculty at the university. And this evening we have the national treasure of Gay Talese with us. He's written 11 books, 4 bestsellers in a row. That's astonishing right there. Some of the books you would recognize, the titles would be The Kingdom and the Power, Honor Thy Father, Thy Neighbor's Wife, Unto the Sons, and his most recent book, memoir called A Writer's Life. Gay Talese, it's a pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, I just love the fact that you were told when you were in high school that you weren't college material. And tell us about how you heard this. It's a little bit in your book, A Writer's Life, but your principal of your high school coming to your father's shop, and then and how that just sort of turned.
Well, the definition of what a good student is very hard to define, because sometimes what people excel at or have some ability in demonstrating isn't necessarily part of the curriculum. So much of being a good student is I guess memorizing what it is that the teacher wishes to have you impart during a test to a page, or verbally maybe impart to a class. What I had going for me, if anything, when I was a student, particularly in high school and grade school before, the only thing I really had was curiosity about people. And there's certainly no grade for that. But without that, you cannot be the kind of journalist or nonfiction writer or historian or even writer of current events. You need curiosity. And you really need the ability to be outside yourself to a degree as well, rather than be narcissistic, so self-absorbed that all you think about is yourself. When I was a kid, meaning when I was in school from my preteen period through the high school years, I did wonder very much about how I differed from those in the class with me. I also had a curiosity about the school janitor, the bus driver, the teachers, of course, particularly one very lovely substitute teacher who, Miss Dorothy Day of all names, who taught French, about which I knew nothing, except I knew Dorothy Day was beautiful, and I fell in love with her when I was a junior in high school.
I'm beginning to see that picture.
And I wrote about her in a fictional way once. But I wondered about people. And then the second thing I had was a way of approaching people with a certain deference. But I wanted to know about them, and I got, I guess, in what I think is sincerely a sincere manner of curiosity. Not an exploitive, not a kind of gossipy curiosity, but rather wanted to know how they got to be what they came to be, what they aspired to be, how they were different from me. All these things I wondered a lot about. A bit of a dazer, I guess. I mean, I guess I had, from the viewpoint of teachers, a sense of being absent from the issues of the class, meaning the class curriculum. But I was just wondering about people.
You were a daydreamer.
I guess that's true enough.
And but, I wasn't. But you weren't looking out the window. You were looking at.
No, I. But
the
I.
French
I would,
teacher.
I would also. I guess in my head these scenes or these situations, I was imagining what people would be like if I could write about them, and I wanted to write about people that were not necessarily known in the way that newspapers write about well-known people, you know, the mayor of the town or the superintendent of schools or chief police or somebody that, or the football coach or somebody that had a station in life or status in life. I didn't have a curiosity about those people so much. It's just ordinary. Where it really began, I think, though, Dean, is my mother was a big influence on me she had a dress shop. It was the premier dress shop in the town. Her women customers, her clients, were middle-aged women, somewhat overweight. In this town, I was born in Ocean City, New Jersey. New Jersey, it's on the southern shore of New Jersey, on the Atlantic Ocean, an island resort. In the summertime, the people from Philadelphia mainly would come and have summer homes. And the better looking and the young people go to the beach. But there are people that didn't go to the beach, a lot of women who didn't go to the beach, and they were the people who came to my mother's store. And the women who came to my mother's store had money. My mother's prices were pretty high for the town. And my mother chose dresses very carefully in the garment centers of New York or Philadelphia. She would go up there with my father sometimes driving. And she had in mind her customers. And she'd choose dresses, and she'd bring them, have them sent down to this store. And she'd call them up, and she'd say, "Ethel Graffius," or whoever it was, "I have something for you." And this woman would come in. And on these occasions, I had, after school, the duty of folding the boxes. You know, which you put it, after you sell a dress, you have tissue paper. And you put. And I was about 11, 12, come home from school, and I would work in this demeaning, but not very, I had a job. And what I found edifying about the job was to watch how my mother would draw in conversation with her customers much about how they were feeling and what they were thinking. Mother was very interested in people as well.
But she did it just by a little prodding here and there.
It wasn't prodding. What it was, you see, my mother was born of an Italian family in the borough of Brooklyn in New York City. And when she married my father in 1928, she left her borough and came to this town, which was quite different from everything she had ever known. The town I was born in, Ocean City, was founded by Methodist ministers in the 1870s. A very Protestant town. We were the few Catholics in the town, and the only Italian-American family in the town that I knew. And my mother, who, while she was born in Brooklyn, and she spoke the language very well, there was no Brooklyn accent in her way of speaking, but she also was a newcomer to the American experience. And these established mainline women were, to her, what she hoped to be as an assimilated person. And so she was into a learning experience in the store. And she would get to know people, first because she had very good taste in clothing. She dressed well herself. She was a very trim and elegant woman. And while her clientele were not trim and elegant, they were people who had a sense of bearing, a sense of assimilation, a sense of confidence, and also knowledge about what was going on in the town, because these were the leading social figures of the town. They were the wives of the mayor, the wives of the leading physician, the wives of the Board of Education superintendent, the wives of prominent attorneys. They were people who had the money and the time at hand to shop. And my mother would just not actually go in to sell a dress necessarily, but to sell herself to them as a person who was sincerely interested in them. And they would tell stories. It wasn't necessarily a talk show in terms of being so complete in the tale, but there'd be stuff that was going on in the town. It wasn't necessarily gossip. It was just private life, their feelings, their impressions of people, their sense of self. And I would, as a boy behind the counter, never interrupting, of course, but I was listening, and I was learning about the town through the kind of oral communication from these women. And I thought, these women are really storytellers. Now, they're not the kind of storyteller that would get the story into the New York or Times or the Ocean City Sentinel Ledger, which was our, but they nevertheless were the kind of stories I later decided that would be in the realm of the short story writer of fiction or the playwright.
Just the everyday life.
The everyday things. I mean, you think about what is it that short story writers have or novelists have. They have the talent to bring a large dimension to people of not necessarily any identity. They are average people that with the imagination of the fiction writer or the playwright, it could be Arthur Miller would be the best example, because his character, Willie Loman, a universal, international character. I mean, the play Death of a Salesman I saw in China in 1998.
Wow.
I mean, that play is in French, it's in Russian, all over.
And it's about just this ordinary guy who's
not
doing well.
Yeah, not a success. Willie Loman is a very mediocre sales guy. He's on a run of bad luck. And he has a relationship with his two sons and his wife, and it's just an average family on the skids with a little bit of illusion and certain amount of hope, but not well-founded on hope. There's no real sense of security in that family. He's every man. But this is a universal character, a great character.
Which is what you've made a career out of writing.
I think there are a lot of Willie Lomans. There are a lot of Willie Lomans out there. The people in this audience, all of them, have their own story. Very few of them probably would write it. There are some writers in this room who might be drawing upon their experience about their parental experience or their town or some aspect of some part of their own lives that they might have put into a story or maybe a play or an essay. Well, as a kid in my mother's store, I was thinking these people, these women, these voices of these women are to be heeded, are to be, attention must be paid, which is right out of the line of Arthur Miller.
Right.
And with regard to Willie, the wife said, attention must be paid to this man. She's exhorting her sons who were disrespectful toward the father, Willie Loman. And I thought attention must be paid to these kind of people. And so that's where it started.
Well, and the way you described your mother, where she just took an interest and sold herself, that people trusted her. I mean, that's pretty much how you've crafted your whole journalism.
And then
career.
I went, and then I left the town when I was 17. I didn't have these grades, but one of the persons that my father made suits for was a doctor from Alabama who settled in our town of Ocean City, New Jersey. And when I couldn't get into a college in Rutgers or any place, I wanted to go to school in New Jersey or Pennsylvania or New York, neighboring states, and I could not get into any. I applied to about 11 colleges. Got into none of them, and this doctor, who was my father's customer and knew my mother, of course, and his wife, the doctor's wife, was also a dress-buying client of my mother. The doctor said, we'll send you to Alabama. We'll get you in Alabama. And I loved the idea of going to college because I would otherwise have not have gone. Alabama was never a place I heard of, and I never imagined even getting there, except there was a train that went from Philadelphia circuitously through dozens of stops. It's about 15 hours getting on that to get to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, which was the home of the university. And I went there, and I worked on the college newspaper. I was not the editor, but I indulged my curiosity and wrote about students and some other people. I'll give you two examples of stories. One story I remember I wrote was about an old black man who was the janitor in the locker room of the University of Alabama athletic department. Football, basketball, baseball, made no difference, this guy. And he was about 80 years old, and he was the grandson of slaves. And this time of which I speak at the University of Alabama was the time of segregation. There was no black student on the campus in that period between 1949 and 1953. But there was this rather ennobling creature who was known popularly as Hooch, H-O-O-C-H, because he did some bootlegging for the team. He made his own hooch. Yeah, this was a dry county. We know about not drinking, don't we? And we know a lot of people do not drink, but on occasion, in secret, they do. And Hooch was their man. And Hooch was this wonderful old guy, not verbal for sure, but I talked to him about his grandfather, and I wrote a story for the college newspaper about him as emerging from slavery. And it got in the Alabama newspaper. It was a respectful piece. And it was a story that indirectly talked to the issue of a man whose past was aligned with what the Civil War was largely about, or partly about. And here he is providing towels for the Alabama sports teams, all of them made up entirely of white people. And his closeness to the team, granted it was a kind of professional relationship as he was hired to do this and do that, and swab the floors and provide soap for the athletes taking showers, etc. But he also was looked upon as a symbol of good luck to the team, because before every game, was it football, basketball, baseball, the players would line up in the locker rooms. They went out to the field or to the basketball court or to the baseball diamond, and they put their hand on his head. They just touched his head as if it was just a good luck post and bang his head, run out.
He was the locker room Buddha.
Quite right. There's a story, you know, it wasn't. And I wrote another story about a student who was from northern Alabama, who was 7 feet tall, and he was in the engineering department. And he'd walk across the campus and find his way into classrooms and stoop here and angle his way into a chair. And he determinedly never wanted to be near an athlete. The coaches would say, wouldn't you like to try basketball? I will have nothing to do with basketball. I don't want any sport. I want to be an engineer. If I'm not to be an engineer, what I want to be, he said, is a tree trimmer. He became a tree trimmer incidentally. Yeah. And I remember this tall guy towering over his classmates who had no particular story and a rather vague definition of himself someday of being a tree trimmer if he couldn't get to be an engineer. It was a non-story, but I just thought the characterization was interesting as how he saw the world from his lofty perch, lofty position, his height, and the height that he had, he determinedly would not put at the service of the athletic department. And I thought there's a stubbornness in this guy. And I just wrote about it, that stubbornness, and it got in the paper. So these are not stories that hit you in the head with their significance. They weren't significant. But they allowed me, as a nonfiction writer, to explore characters quite different from myself. The old black man, sure. The towering student, not wanting to be Shaq, some superstar basketball NBA hero.
Because everybody else, and to this day, even it seems like it's hyper this way, is we're talking about the latest and the most celebrity type. I mean, that's and whatever is the most popular. And you've made this whole industry out of people on the margins, losers.
It was trying to bring to nonfiction, whether it's journalism, and we're talking about factual reporting. We're not talking about making anything up. We're talking about how far can you go by exploring the lives of people who do not have a presence with regard to being newsworthy, who are not recognized as special or identifiable. And can you, with the effort of your writing, with the prose, with the scene setting, with the descriptive powers of the English language, using it properly, can you make these people come alive on a page? And can you allow that page to find readers? Will readers stay with your writing? They will if it captures them, captures
sure.
their imagination.
You know, you made a statement in another location where you said it takes you 10 years to write a book. 10 years? Are you kidding
yeah,
me? You sure that isn't 9 years of just going to Elaine's and 1 year of
no, it isn't.
Cranking?
No, you made reference to the last book, A Writer's Life. And that is a book about curiosity, and it's about my own curiosity sometimes carried to excess.
Is it that excess that, you know, was
well,
in that decade?
What it is that I do, I wonder, as I did as a high school student, and I'm now much more than a senior citizen, but it's the same curiosity that reverberates within me. And I just use as an example this curiosity and how sometimes it becomes obsessive. I watched just on an idle Saturday back in the summer of 1999, I was in New York, and I was watching women play soccer. And I thought, nothing's more boring to me than soccer because I don't understand it. And so women playing soccer would not be interesting at all, but it was on ABC. And it was an afternoon where I didn't know what to do with my time, and I sometimes channel surf to get my mind off myself, and I watched anything that's on television. And this was 3 or 4 in the afternoon on ABC, and it was in the Pasadena's Rose Bowl. And there were 90,000 people watching two women's teams, one from the United States and one from China, play in this World Cup. I didn't know what it's like the World Series of soccer with women. And the Chinese team was considered almost a match for the American team. And the game went on for 2 hours or more than that. It was 0-0. There's no scoring at all. And it was decided finally by penalty kicks. And I would learn from the announcer that five women from the American team and five women from the Chinese team, after the game ended 0-0, would alternately take a kick from 12 feet away or 12 yards away and try to kick it into the goal from a standing position. And of the 10 people, 9 did succeed in kicking the ball past the goaltender into the net. And one lost. And that one who lost was the Chinese woman, one of the Chinese women. So the game was lost. The Chinese women and the American women left the field. 90,000 people cheered. President Clinton was incidentally in that crowd. And it was on television, so millions of people watched. And I was thinking, that Chinese woman is probably 22 or 23. And she's in the Rose Bowl. And that television, ABC, was all over the United States and around the world was watching. And women in China, we think about China as this emerging world power, and indeed it is. And we think about women in China. What do we think of? Well, I thought of bound feet, old women, bound feet in the old China before the revolution, during the age of the dynasty, you know, the last emperor. People saw the movie, that period, I was thinking. Now, that this girl who missed that kick wearing those cleats, those Nike sneakers, was probably the granddaughter of a woman bound feet. And I thought, if I can get to that woman that missed the kick, that woman who probably had to overcome the humiliation in front of all these people in Southern California, and all those people on television, she has to go back with her teammates on a plane, fly all the way back from Los Angeles to wherever in China. The plane landed Shanghai or Beijing, I don't know where. If I could get to that young woman and could hang out with her, and much of my way of research is hanging out with people. I don't interview them right away. I just hang out with them. And if I could go to China and follow her around for a while after she adjusts to the ignominious experience in front of so many people of failing her team and failing her nation, failing herself, I'd probably learn a lot about the emerging personality of a young woman, new to the limelight, very new. Women in China were just, I imagine, emerging as co-equal people with men. And I thought, I learned something about the new China. I mean, you can write about China from the political point of view, the military point of view, or the financial point of view, and the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times, and all the LA Times. There's always money, 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 money. You know, the price of the RMB, all this fine. But to tell the story of China from a woman who at an early age experienced disappointment on a grand scale, and to know about who her mother was and who her grandmother was, you could get a sense of the changing China from the perspective of a soccer player, a woman soccer player. And that's why I went over there at my own expense, because I tried to sell the idea to Sports Illustrated. No one was interested. Who cares about this Chinese woman? You know, if I was writing about some Gao Hong or some star or some well-known tennis player, maybe I could have done it, but not her.
But not a loser.
And I thought she was not a loser, but she did lose. She cost loss. She cost the team an event that lost the game. But I thought she has a story. And but no one wanted to pay my way to China, that's for sure. And I thought, well, why don't I just go myself? I'll go myself. I didn't know anybody in China. I didn't speak a word of the language. I had never been there. So I
called. You just flew to China. Well, actually, you were coming back from a cruise, an anniversary. Well, with your wife.
I was with my wife. We were celebrating an anniversary. We will have been married next year, 50 years. And we were
So you get in a plane after that and you go to China just
to
find somebody.
Well, we were in Frankfurt and she went to the Frankfurt Book Fair. My wife is a book publisher for many years. And I always had a ticket back to New York. And I said goodbye to Nan at Frankfurt. And I had about 2 hours to go to wait for my flight from Frankfurt, Germany to New York. And no, this was a month after that soccer match I'd seen on the television. I'd been thinking about it. I'm going to go to China. So I asked Lufthansa if they had a flight to Beijing, the capital of China. She said, no, you have to go to Hong Kong first. So I went to Hong Kong. I bought a ticket. I left word at the hotel. I knew my wife was staying in Frankfurt. I said, I'm not coming home. I'm going to China.
I've been delayed.
And I got a ticket to go to Hong Kong. And I went to Hong Kong and went to a hotel. I went to a good hotel because I had to have someone I sure spoke English. If you're traveling around the world, I don't care if you're in Africa or wherever you are, if you go to a pretty good hotel, someone is going to speak English. Anywhere in the world, the concierge of any hotel in the world most likely will speak or will know someone who speaks English. So I went to Hong Kong, and I didn't know that a lot of people spoke English there. I just wasn't thinking that clearly. But I said, I want to go to Beijing. You have to get a visa to it. So I went to Beijing, which is just an hour and a half flight. And I went to Beijing, I went to a hotel, and I found someone who spoke English there. And I asked him, do you know if there is a Nike office in Beijing? So he looked in the yellow pages of whatever the yellow pages are in China. And he said, yes, there is. So the next day I asked him if he would call Nike in China, in Beijing, ask if there was anybody who spoke English. Because what I wanted to do was I thought through the manufacturer of the sneaker, I could find out who bought the sneakers for the Chinese, because I knew the Chinese team were wearing these, both American, they're all wearing either Adidas or Nike,
right.
I knew one or the other.
Right.
And so I finally had lunch the next day with this man from Nike in China who spoke English, and he said he could get me to the coach, and from the coach he would then ask if I could see the girl. It took 2 weeks, and I didn't speak any Mandarin, so I had to hire an interpreter. But I was able to finally get to her, and I stayed 5 months in Beijing.
Now that's hanging around.
That's hanging around. And you know, you say, well, why do you spend that much? Who cares? Well, you can't ask that question, who cares, because too often the answer is nobody except you. I care.
It's still worth it then.
For me, it was. I mean, I take from my life in the 50 years I've been a published writer of nonfiction. It's all nonfiction, meaning it's not work of imagination. Yes, it's the realm of curiosity can take you many places, but it's based on curiosity. The second is to take the initiative to indulge your curiosity, in this case, fly to China. Third is to take the time, 5 months in this case, to get to know a person a bit. And fourthly, never to ask, will it sell? Never to ask, is this a publishable piece? Really what you do is you get the story and you write it. And after you write it, it still might not be publishable, mm-hmm. but you have to take chances. It's risk-taking. In my work, so much of what I've done for 50 years, in one sense, is wasting time. Wasting time. 80%, perhaps, of the research I do never finds its way in a useful way into what I write. I use the 20%.
But here's this line from A Writer's Life. I am a prolific author of unfinished manuscripts. So, this is evidence. I mean,
this book, A Writer's Life, which is about that, which is where you're quoting, was made up of this Chinese story that no one would publish. No one would publish that book, that article about, because they never did it, and no one would publish it. I tried to get it in the New Yorker and Esquire, and nobody would publish it. There's another story in that same book. I wanted to write about a restaurant that was so terrible in New York that no matter, that was a restaurant location.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, it was almost, you felt like it was
and
almost
I
demon possessed.
Felt that this building within which during a 20-year period, there were 13 restaurants open and closed in one place. I knew that building because I lived in the neighborhood and I watched the, every 2 years there was a different restaurant and none of them succeeded. And I thought, this is the Willy Loman of buildings in New York.
Yeah.
And I wrote at 206 East 63rd, and I did the history of all those failed restaurants. It's very hard to do research on a restaurant that's not there anymore. You can't Google that. You don't kind of get in there and do it. You have to find, oh, there used to be a waiter there, and the waiter knew the chef. Where's the chef now? He works in Philadelphia. You go to Philadelphia and talk. What was it? You know, you have to, it's an awful lot of legwork, and you wonder for what purpose. Again, a misspent adventurous imagination, a wayward mentality. I don't know what it is, but it is certainly propelled by this curiosity that is unrelenting. And I did that story, and no one wanted that story. And there's another story about a sheriff in Alabama who was the sheriff. His name is Jim Clark, and he was the guy that tried to stop Martin Luther King in the march. In 1965 was the famous march from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery, Alabama, in the way of achieving the voting rights bill, which did come out under the Johnson administration. But I wanted to tell the story of that Selma march years later from the vantage point of two people. One was this redneck sheriff, and the other was from the vantage point of a black attorney who was born in Selma and was the only attorney that got a degree to practice law in Selma. And he was the advisor to Martin Luther King in Alabama during that whole civil rights period from 1963, 64, 65, up until the time of King's death in 1968 in Memphis. And so those two characters who had been adversarial in 1965, I wanted to look up in 1999, 2000, to see how the changing of America's policy towards segregation and to the degree the elevation of the American consciousness beyond a racist mentality. I wanted to write about the voting rights bill through those two people. Today we have in this country of ours a kind of a rising of that spirit of we shall overcome in the voting for Barack Obama. Many Americans do not see him as a racial figure. We have elevated ourselves as a nation, whether you're for whoever you're for, it makes no difference. But the fact is, this is the first black man who's entered the American mainstream. I think it's a very significant event. And I do believe that Americans are far, far, far less likely to be called racist today, sincerely, than was the case when the civil rights marches of the mid-1960s were in the headlines all the time. I further believe that part of the reason for this, we must, whether you like him or not, thank the president we have now. I am not a fan of George Bush, speaking personally, but what he did, I think, is in his elevation to the position of Secretary of State, two black people, two African Americans, first General Powell and later Condoleezza Rice, and allow them to represent the country internationally. And we saw them on television, first the general, later Condoleezza Rice, talking to the Arabs, talking to the French president, talking to the leaders in England and Ireland and all over the world, Germany. The American people, through television and through the acceptance of the American office of the Secretary of State being personified by an African-American, dealing with our government, representing, I believe that that has had much to do with the acceptance to the degree that he is acceptable as a candidate of the Democratic Party of a Barack Obama. I think that, I mean, how things sure. happen, that's sure. my little, I don't, sure. I haven't read that by some political writer in any of the trenchant newspapers, but that's what I feel.
Well, actually, just the way you've been speaking the last several minutes reminds me, actually, of the way you write. And so let me see if I can characterize the way you write, and you tell me if you think this is, if this is accurate or intentional or whatever. When I was reading through A Writer's Life, I thought, okay, he's drawing this circle, and I don't know where this circle's going. And then you launch off into some other story. You start with China, and then you launch into the Bobbitt family, and then you're in Selma, and you
the
just
restaurant.
Keep drawing in the restaurants, and you keep drawing these circles. And yet, every time the circle closes, you've overlapped the last one, and then the next one you've drawn, you've overlapped something in those
yeah.
two, and you've drawn all these circles, and yet they all have a center. Or there's some shared space in there. Now, is that from listening to your mom and dad in...
No, that isn't necessarily... It is that... Well, I'm writing about, as I am in this book, how the mind works and how the curiosity drives you in certain directions. And then once you've finished that research, once you've satisfied your curiosity, the next step is how do you organize your material? When I started writing in a way beyond just daily journalism, meaning when I started writing for magazines and had, instead of 800 words, maybe 8,000 words that I could have at my disposal, or later 80,000 words or 185,000 words, whatever it is, it's very important to have a sense of organization that is akin to choreography. I go over my research material again and again and again to the point where it no longer is something that I've sought out, but it's something I have sought out and brought into myself and in a way own. I become so familiar with the people's lives that I'm interested in writing about or circumstances of their lives or their history that I become identified with it to the point that it becomes my history. Their way of thinking becomes a way that I can think along the lines that they think, so I think. And there's a blending here. Mm-hmm. And then the important thing is where I work, I have a house in New York and I have a house in the Jersey Shore, and I have in both places where I work, the walls are lined with, instead of corkboard, they're lined with styrofoam material, insulation material, like this white wall board. They're in big 4 foot, 6 foot length, 3 foot high. They're tacked to the wall, and I pin with dressmaker pins, little cards that are, in my mind, how I'm going to introduce to the reader what I'm writing about. And the second card, and the third card, and the fourth card, and the 80th card around the room.
That's how filmmakers work.
I'm visualizing.
That's how filmmakers work. That's storyboarding.
Well, that's a storyboard. But I also think of it in terms of steps like a choreographer, with, a Balanchine, or they take a dancer. It could be a ballet dancer. It could be Gene Kelly singing in the rain. But every step of Singing in the Rain, you think, oh, he made it up. Everything, the arch, the way you lean against maybe the curb in the rain, and the way the foot moves and moving of the body, all of that, point by point by point by point, has gone over and over and over and over by the people who are the choreographers of that particular scene in a movie, or a great scene of the Ballet Russe. What's the difference? It looks as if it's easy. It looks as if it's almost improvised, but it's not. It's organized. It is very precisely, second by second, thought through. That's the way I organize my material. And then I write that way. So you think you're lost, but there's always a pin in here. Exactly.
There were times when I'd read some of your stuff and I'd think, I have no idea where this is going. I hope you do. And sure enough, I'd be found. And that it was just, I've never read anybody the way you do. The way you write, it's just masterful in my opinion. But here,
anyway.
you said something about art that what you just described, that's hard work.
It is hard work, but I think that writing shouldn't be too easy.
Why not? Don't you know that somebody just published a novel? By putting it on a cell phone? She texted a 40,000-word novel on a cell phone? Come on, how hard can this be?
Well, I guess it can be easy for some people who are maybe natural writers.
I mean, you're not a natural writer?
No, I don't think I'm a natural writer. I think I'm a hard-working writer, and I'm a careful writer. And I also have, if I'm a vain person, it probably is in this sense, that I hope that what I write will be readable long, long after I've written it and published it.
That's why then you said writing is like passing a kidney stone. Because you said, if you're going to put this much work into something, you want to make sure it lasts, right?
Yeah, well, you're not sure it's lasting. You're not sure. You hope. It's all hope, faith. It isn't any guarantee. There's no guarantee. There's just you writing not for the moment. You say people can write a novel over the, you know, cell phone. Well, maybe they can, and good luck to them. But it's not what I do, and I don't know how to do it. And I don't know how to even take advantage of the technology. There are people that, because of their use of the technology, they can Google information. I would take a week to get what they can find out in 5 seconds. Like, who was the vice president of the United States when the president was Garfield? Well, any intelligent person in this room could find out in a second. I would kind of want to look at the history books. And in the flipping through the history books, I would see more than that.
You
would
find some obscure
character. Sometimes the difficult way, when you're not linear, when you're not goal-oriented, I think one of the problems with journalism today, and maybe problems with life in general today, people are goal-oriented. They want to go from here to there with the least amount of time-wasting. I said before, time-wasting sometimes can be very valuable to how you define time-wasting. But I think that serendipitously, you come upon things by chance that are wonderful. And you cannot, in your, you know, like people have these cars, you want to go from here to Pasadena, you push a button and you go to sleep and you follow the thing and you go. Sometimes if you make wrong turns, you come upon, they're not destinations, but these little obscured wrong turns can get you into place where you met somebody or saw something that's just wondrous. And that's not guaranteed, but you might find them.
And you've made a lifetime of saying that it's worth the risk, right?
Well, it has been enriching for me. I don't recommend it for people who are more pragmatic than I am or who have maybe a greater productive sense than I do. I mean, who want to be prolific and turn out the work and cash in and be in the newspapers every year with a new achievement. I'm not driven that way.
You're not that guy.
I don't think so. The
movie Capote was so popular recently, and I was just struck by having read a bunch of his stuff and then with you here, I'm thinking, people feel differently or after you write about them than they felt after Capote wrote about them. How are you different
I don't know.
From him?
Capote, first of all, was about as much of a celebrity as a writer can ever be. I mean, we have our sense of celebrity by movie stars or entertaining figures or entertainment figures or great political figures, you know, presidents, etc. But writers are more solitary people. There are some who had a gigantic personality that made them into celebrities, such as Ernest Hemingway, I guess, was the first. I mean, the first that I think of in the general area of my lifetime. Capote was certainly that. Partly because he was such an eccentric character. You talk about attention getting, he really caught your attention. That squeaky, hilariously bizarre way of speaking. The fact that he loved getting attention. When he posed for his first book, it might not have been his first book, but some book, he was on a sofa, sprawled out. He liked being the center of attention, but what should not be underestimated, I don't have to even mention it, it's so obvious, he was a wonderful writer.
He's a wonderful writer, but he used people.
Well, I don't want to sound as if I'm, especially as he's passed on his reward, I'm sure his reward is in a very showy place, but I feel, for what he was, aside from all the other stuff that made him famous and got him on talk shows and the subject of movies, he was, at heart, a wonderful use. The American language is a beautiful language if used well, and he did use the language well. I mean, there are a lot of writers who are maybe famous, but they're storytellers, and they don't, I mean, they're formulaic writers, they might be mystery writers, they might be other genre writers, but they don't care that much about language. I mean, Capote did. Philip Roth does, John Updike does.
the late William Styron. My favorite writer was John Fowles, English writer who died 1520. Even the French Lieutenant's Woman, Daniel Martin. If you read these novels, the paragraphs are beautiful. You want to reread them. I love when you read a writer, not necessarily an American, any person that's a good writer and happened to be well translated, such as Gabriel Garcia Marquez, for example, or Tolstoy, for example. They're beautiful passages, and you want to reread them. They're poetic, they're lyrical. That isn't done on a cell phone, you know, quick. I mean, I think you have to work. Hemingway worked on his, or Proust. And, you know, we all have our favorites, but I like that.
I'm going to read you a sentence. This is my favorite Gay Talese published sentence.
Okay, well, go ahead.
This is one sentence. You mentioned Tolstoy. This is Tolstoyan. All right, this is about you going into a restaurant and the advantages and disadvantages of going into a restaurant and why you like to eat in restaurants. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No,
I mean,
ahead.
Do you know what sentence?
No.
Check this out. I have to take a deep breath. I have the option of tuning out, half listening, drifting about mentally while glancing around at the crowded and noisy dining room, watching almost simultaneously a sporting event being shown on television above a bar, an attractive blonde sitting sideways on a stool, and a fat man sitting at a nearby table with his mouth open, about to devour a piece of fish, slender slice of flounder, and suddenly I imagine the fish coming to life, jumping off the fork, wiggling along the floor, and being retrieved by a waiter who carries it in a napkin back to the kitchen, where I have visions of the fish swimming backward in time, a flashback fish floating freely, nice alliteration there, 10 days before the sea, before in the Labrador Sea of northeastern Canada, a fish that is flat-bodied and pancake size and has two eyes on the same side of its head, a Picasso fish, cruising easily along the muddy bottom of the sea in search of a shrimp until 5 minutes before sunrise, it glides into a net, is trapped, is confused, is frightened, but is not alone. Hundreds of other Picasso-eyed flounder are ensnared there, swirling around, bumping into one another, angling to flip over to their seeing eye side, hoping to figure out what's going on. But then they are squeezed together as the big net soars drippingly out of the sea and scrapes along the side of a ship that is piloted by a bearded, brandy-breathed, scrawny, wife-abusing French-Canadian fisherman who had been illegally trawling in that area all week, and who now, after grabbing fistfuls of wiggling fish out of the net with his gloved hands, hurls them into an ice-filled hold into the stern of his ship, and then starts up his engine for the six-hour journey to the dockside depot of a seafood distributorship in Newfoundland, from which the fish will be flown in a day later in a refrigerated aluminum container to JFK Airport in New York, where the mafia-affiliated Teamsters will receive them and drive them to the Fulton Street Market, then deliver them into the hands of a wholesale dealer whose van on the following morning will be double-parked in front of the myriad Manhattan restaurants, including Elaine's, where the fish will be counted and examined by Elaine's Neapolitan chef and will be cleaned by her Spanish-speaking scullions and will be prepared and offered that night as a fresh fish special, Flounder Meunier Almondine, $29, and this is what was ordered by and brought to the fat man I saw sitting in front of me with his mouth agape. That's you! That's you! Now, if that
is a long sentence, isn't it?
That's a long sentence. In all honesty, I tried to do it in one breath one time. I thought I was going to pass out. But I'm thinking, now this... This would have taken months to write and make sure that you got the commas and the...
Yeah.
I lost track of what the subject and the object and the... holy cow, why do you do that?
It did occur to me watching that man in that restaurant, and I just thought, what happened? That the history of the fish, the backward history of a fish.
Who thinks of that? He was just trying to eat some fish.
But it's really, it's just amazing when you go to, just a restaurant, how the vegetables and everything that's served, it comes from so far. I mean, the fact that it's so much effort is put into what is finally a menu. I mean, a menu. We read a menu. I'll have this and have that. No onions on this, and a lot on the gravy here. But all of the preparation, far beyond the kitchen, we're talking about weeks ago preparation in growing the vegetables or delivering the potatoes.
You're doing it again.
Well, I mean, but you could take any, you know, whether you're driving a car and all the parts of a car. There's a great novel. I mentioned Don DeLillo. Does anyone read a Don DeLillo book? There's one book, it's called, I think it's called Underworld, big novel. And there's a scene of a student talking to his teacher, and this teacher points at his shoes, speaking of shoes before. And the teacher said, "Do you know how many parts there are that make up a shoe?" And the student had not a clue. And this teacher went into all the things, named all the parts of a shoe. And you say, well, who cares? Well, not many people. But obviously, I thought that was interesting, that the researching writer, Don DeLillo, a fiction writer, would wonder about that. And so similarly, Philip Roth, who's, I think, one of the finest novelists we have, I think the book was called American Pastoral, and that one of the characters in that novel is a glove maker. And you learn all the parts of a glove. So sometimes a fiction writer will take a shoe or a glove and just do what few readers care to do, but they're interested when they read about such a, not insignificant, but curious interest in what a glove, all the parts of a glove. Well, I have that as a nonfiction writer. So when I go, whatever I'm doing, I wonder about things. This is with the daydreamer. You know, I mentioned in school when I was 14 years old and not
see,
doing very well.
See, that circle is starting to complete.
Looking out the window and wondering, a sense of wonderment, a sense of this isn't naivete. It's a sense of the magic of ordinary life.
Well, all of this brings me to one of my favorite Gay Talese quotes, which is, "I seemed to possess in my writing a precocious flair for rhetoric and circumlocution long before I could spell either word." So that's a great line. Okay, we've got some writers in our audience and viewers. Give us some advice. Young writers, people who think they've got a story to tell.
Well, it is imperative that you not be discouraged by rejection. Easily said, I know.
You still get rejected.
I know I do. I've gotten rejection when I was, 26, and when I'm 76, it's the same. I'm just trying to tell you, or tell people in this audience who aspire to be writers, that part of it is going to be rejection. I mean, I probably, too, of any performer or any kind of endeavor you might pursue, it could be sports. I mean, it could be, an athlete has to know about rejection. You take the New England Patriots team. I mean, that quarterback and the whole team, they had everything, a dream, great season, and then in a matter of a couple of hours, in a matter of a couple of minutes, actually. And to the great downer. But next year, or a prize fighter gets knocked out, or someone loses the election, Edwards drops out.
Yeah.
He had been an aspiring politician within the Democratic Party, vice presidential candidate 4 years ago, and it's all over. And so a writer who writes or maybe proposes a memo for, outline and gets rejected, and you can't. There's an agent, a friend of mine in the room tonight, and she knows better than I do how important it is for writers not to be discouraged by rejection.
She's rejected me countless times.
She did?
Oh, yeah, countless. I can't count the
Well,
times.
It is sadly true that many good writers do not get published. And my wife, who's been in book publishing for all of our married life, close to a half century right now, once said, and maybe more than once said, there are more writers than readers anymore. And I don't know how true that is. I hope it's not true at all. But the writer is, I mean, I have writer friends. I have one writer friend who's an immensely successful writer. His name is John Berendt. And he wrote a book called Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil that became a bestseller for like 2 years on the hardcover bestseller. That book was turned down not only by a dozen editors, but was turned down by his agent before she sent it to the editors. The agent said, there's no way, John, that anyone's going to read a book about Savannah, Georgia. I mean, who cares about them? You know, there's no way these eccentric characters. And he changed agents and pitched the book to another editor, and the other turned it down. And some junior editor, as I remember the story, probably partly true, maybe not entirely true, but it was a junior editor at Random House that sort of liked the book and said, let's do it, let's take a chance. And there's a book that sells several hundred thousand hardcover. Well, I think Joe Heller at Catch-22, that book was turned down by a dozen or more editors. So if you're, you know, you could be the next Joe Heller or the next John Berendt or the next Herman Melville that never was aware of any success in his lifetime, for Moby Dick or Bartleby the Scribner. I think of myself as Bartleby sometimes. You just don't know. What you have is tremendous sense of perseverance, which is what I write about often. That little girl from the Chinese soccer team, she had to persevere. Tom Brady will persevere, surely, but a lot of people that aren't as good as Tom Brady or as rich as Tom Brady or as talented as Tom Brady also have to persevere. And these are the ordinary people that I'm interested in writing about, the Willie Lomans, and that's important.
As readers, we're glad you persevered, and here's how I'd like to finish our time together. This is Gay Talese's birthday, and I think we all ought to sing happy birthday to him.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Lou Gay. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.